Michael and Sam have just moved to Santa Carla, California. They're about to discover its secret.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
I'm a stranger when you're a stranger.
So where are you? The flying nun!
I'm your brother, Sammy. Help me!
Stay back! Stay back!
What's happening to me, Star?
Get yourself a good sharp stake. Drive it right through his heart.
You're a vampire, Michael!
My own brother, a damn blood-sucking vampire!
Oh, you wait till Mom finds out, buddy!
When a vampire buys it, it's never a pretty sight.
Michael, they're coming! Oh, shit!
Welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And as we count down to Halloween, I'm, of course, doing lots and lots of scary movies. And if you're talking scary movies, there is one person I've always wanted to have on the show who's an expert at scary movies, my longtime friend, writer and journalist, April Snellings. Hello, April. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Rob, it's so great to talk to you. I haven't talked to you actually, you know, on the phone in a real capacity in a very long time. So it's so nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, we've been in each other's orbit for a very long time, and I'm a big fan of April. April does lots of writing on movies. She is a particular horror movie expert. How's the purchase of The Giant Werewolf coming? Is that a thing yet? Or?
Well, interestingly enough, my wife's coworker started a fund for me. So I don't know if that makes me really awesome or really pitiful, but they are trying to come up with the money to buy me a werewolf. So who knows? But yeah, you know, it's going.
That's a good. I love the idea that your wife was like, "No, we're not getting that." And then your friends are just like, "We're gonna go do an end run around here. We're gonna buy April this werewolf, damn, this giant 6-foot real life werewolf. That's fantastic."
Isn't it great? Isn't it great? And they've been kind of coaching her and telling her that she needs to try to negotiate with the store and try to, you know, there's a push, man. There's a push. So we'll see.
That's fantastic. So anyway, the movie we're here to talk about is The Lost Boys from 1987, directed by Joel Schumacher. Now, I will admit, April, I've been wanting to have April on the show for a really long time because, like I said, I'm a huge fan. April's just one of the best people I know, and she's a very good writer, and I was like, I just want to have her on. And so I said, well, just name me whatever movie you want to talk about. I don't care, obscure, not obscure, we'll do it. So right. April writes back and says, The Lost Boys. And I would admit, my first reaction was like, ugh. Because I saw this movie one time 30 years ago, you know, when it was on cable, and I don't remember being that thrilled with it. And I was like, okay, maybe I don't have a lot to say about this movie, but I want to have April on so bad, I'll watch it again. What the hell? So I rewatched it, I don't know, a month ago, whatever it was, and I liked it way better than I remember. It's way better a movie than I remember. So I don't know what my problem was when I was a kid, but I really enjoyed this movie. So why did you want to talk about this one?
You know, the movie is, it's important to me, and I feel like that's kind of a weird thing to say. But okay, a little bit of background. This movie came out when I was 11, okay? And I was really into horror, like really, really into horror.
But I was also,
right, you know, way back then, little me, right? But, you know, it was weird because I was also terrified of it. And thinking back about, you know, what it was that affected me, I did not watch, you know, it was the 80s, right? And you could get around the whole R-rated thing really easily, you know, VCRs and slumber parties. But I was terrified of watching, you know, any of the slasher movies that were coming out. And even though I was really interested and I wanted to, I was so afraid of blood. I was just, and it wasn't the idea of the slashers or, you know, it wasn't any of that. I was just so scared of the idea of seeing blood. So, and I'm sure that a therapist could make a huge case out of this, but I was also really into vampires, right?
I'm sensing a bit of a problem.
Right. Like, I would get, you know, gosh, I would get in trouble all the time at school for having vampire books in class. And, you know, it was a big deal with some of the teachers. And, you know, I was just really into all things vampire. And The Lost Boys came out, and I was obsessed even before the movie came out. Okay. I started a scrapbook before the movie came out. By the time it was all said and done, I had 3 volumes of my Lost Boys scrapbook. You know, I don't know. Something about it just spoke to me. Something about the idea of it, you know, the trailers, the press images that were coming out. It just appealed to me. But it's R-rated, right? So I had to talk my mom into taking me to see it. And man, I begged. Like, it was a long campaign to convince my mom to take me to this movie. And she knew that, you know, that I had that weird issue with gore, and, you know, there was obviously going to be some, but she finally, I think I was just relentless, right? And she took me to see it. And, you know, just from the beginning, it was like, wow, you know, just, I was really into that, and I was too young to be a part of it. But the idea of that 80s kind of youth culture, just, you know, this kid from Tennessee, and I'm so far removed from that, but I love it. So she takes me to this movie, and, you know, I'm just thinking, I can't freak out, right? And I had a history of not responding well to scary things in movies at theaters. When Clash of the Titans came out, she took me to see that in the theater because I begged, because it was monsters, and I had a meltdown, like complete screaming, crying meltdown. So, you know, I had a past, but she took me. I loved it. I loved it immediately. And then you get to the first really violent scene is the surf Nazis massacre, right? At the campfire. And I was like, oh shit, you know, there's blood, there's gore, and it's right. But I kept it together and I did okay. And then there's Marcos, and I assume that spoilers are okay, right? Everybody interested is gonna, okay. So then there's Marcos' death, and it's just batshit, right? It's just like, and it's not even gore. It's like, you know, just vampire ick, you know, just
like spurting and yeah.
And it's everywhere, and I'm watching this and I'm thinking, shit, Snellings, you know, just keep it together. You can't look away. You can't freak out. Cause this is it, right? There will be no more, no more R-rated horror if you can't make it through this. And then it occurred to me, like halfway through that scene, I'm like, wait a minute, this is fun. You know, like, this is awesome. This is, it's fake and it's not threatening and it's just goofy and it's amazing. And after that, I was able to watch all the 80s horror and all the, you know, whatever. It didn't bother me anymore. So The Lost Boys kind of, you know, I don't know that I would be, I don't know that I would be doing what I'm doing had I not had that great kind of revelation and had The Lost Boys not gotten me past that fear of, you know, of practical effects and gore and all that kind of stuff that I had.
Interesting.
So that's one facet of why it's, you know, so important to me. And yeah, there are others, but
yeah, I mean, it's a movie that manages to do, you know, that horror comedy balance pretty well, because the horror stuff is pretty serious.
It is, it's scary.
But yeah, I mean, it's not done for laughs. But then it has all the goofy stuff of the Frog Brothers and them in the comic book store and all that. So it really does manage to hit that. And you know, Joel Schumacher, not known for that, for having a light touch necessarily. Mm-hmm. Especially mm-hmm. in his later films. And it's funny because, I mean, if you read the on IMDb, the plot of this movie is, after moving to a new town, two brothers discover that the area is haven for vampires. Fine, that's great. But I'm betting that when Schumacher was selling this, or Richard Donner, who produced it, was selling it to the studio, I bet they just said, MT Vampires. Like, to me, that's the pitch of this movie, is that it's MT
that's the hook.
Mixed with vampires.
Yep. And like, I don't know if you know any of the background with the script. But when it was – when like the first draft of the script, they were all much younger, and it was kind of a G-rated –
like Goonies type thing.
Goonies rip-off. Right, yeah. It was like very family-friendly, very – yeah. And it was Schumacher that came in and said, ugh, God, no, I don't want to – let's not do that. Let's do this thing. And I don't know that there were any – I don't know that there had been anything in that world that hit on that culture the way – Lost Boys did at that time. It was new. right? It was like, and it's such an obvious thing now to look back at it. It's like, of course, you know, MTV and monsters and vampires, it works. But it, nobody knew that it worked then, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was I think the studios were still like a little looking askance at MTV culture. It's like, is this, you know, can this really support a movie? And of course, eventually we just take over movies, basically.
Right, the aesthetic. Right.
I can't help but when I look at Corey Haim and all of his T-shirts, like they all look like those MTV interstitial graphics that they had, with like the little squigglies and the line. Like this, this movie is just MTVing all over the place, and it looks beautiful. I mean, it's the cinematography is beautiful. It has the rich, deep colors. I mean, it really has that aesthetic. But again, it gives you enough of kind of grit to hang on. I mean, I don't know, but the performances, like Jason Patrick, like he set a million girls' hearts aflutter.
Oh, in mine included. Yep.
So okay, so that worked on you in 1987. That
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, still Kiefer Sutherland was the draw. You know, the big, like yeah, but yeah, I mean, he was hot. You know, he was. And looking back on it now, it's like, you know, I don't know that I don't see it as much now, but when I was 11, it was, you know, yeah, good looking guy and that sultry, you know, and the, I don't know, it worked.
He's sensitive, you know, and he's sensitive too. He's not a, true. He's not a lout and whatever. I mean, of course you do have the bad guy, Kiefer Sutherland, who I am firmly convinced that Kiefer Sutherland as the head vampire is playing the same character he played in Stand By Me.
You know, he had just finished Stand By Me then.
Right.
So I bet you're right. I bet, that had to all have been like fresh. You know, and then sure.
The guy eventually leaves the town. He leaves Castle Rock, and he gets bit by a vampire, becomes a vampire, and he lives forever.
Changes his name to David.
It's perfect. It all tracks. I mean, you know, you even have a similar scene where one character is basically saying, "I'm just going to kill you because you're the head."
Right.
Of this group, which is what happens in Stand By Me. So it's like it's the same thing. Somebody's got to kill this guy finally. I mean, it's just, but no, I mean, I love, I had to laugh in the beginning scenes of this movie where, like, the way that we established how badass these punks are, these vampires, that they're throwing a merry-go-round.
Like, I know.
Tough guys.
I love it. And, you know, you mentioned how good it looks. And I don't know that a lot of people know that it was shot by the guy who shot Taxi Driver, right? And Raging Bull. I mean, it was Michael Chapman's. One of the big time cinematographers. So the movie has a lot going for it, you know, kind of before you even get to the story and into the characters. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah. I mean, like Jamie Gertz, who is ostensibly the main female in this movie. I get maybe Diane Weiss, but Jamie Gertz is certainly the love interest because that's the character that Jason Patrick sees from afar and he completely transpires. Now, Jamie Gertz, I don't think has been particularly like great in movies, but she looks phenomenal here. I mean, the way
she's
dressed,
gorgeous,
she looks like a gypsy. Like, you could see why maybe Jason Patrick's character would spot her from afar and go, whoa. And just in terms of like if you were a movie director, like a movie studio, you would look at her in this movie and say, oh, this chick's going to be a star. She's got it. And the fact that she was not it in other movies, I think says more about that maybe they didn't know what to do with her. Because here, she, like, I see her fitting in those, like, those 1940s Universal Wolfman movies. Like,
absolutely.
She's that captivating.
Yeah. Absolutely, she's, you know, those eyes, and she, and of course, you know why I'm a Jamie Gertz fan, because she was on Facts of Life, so.
Right, she of was, course, Facts of Life. We do have to remember, mention it to everybody, April is a Facts of Life mega fan. I mean, is it fair to say that it has partly guided your life, Facts of Life?
Yes, absolutely, oh, absolutely, for whatever anybody can take from that, you know, I don't know, but yeah, it's been a big influence. I don't know, Rob, man. It's just weird stuff, right? I don't know.
Hey,
I don't know sometimes.
Know, you do you, April. I mean, we all have our things. I mean, come on, you know. But she looks great. And I don't know. I notice that stuff more as I get older, where you see someone who didn't quite work out in movies, and you say, well, is it because they weren't that great? And then you see them great in something else, and you go, no, it's just they weren't – the other people didn't know how to use them correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. That's a good point.
Because
she's fantastic. She has that look, and she, you know, she's done so much TV that I wonder if there are, you know, if there are just things that you do on TV that don't translate as well to film. I don't know, but yeah, she's terrific, and you just can't imagine anybody else as star. I mean, that's such a great character, and her performance is just so, it's just spot on, right?
Yeah, you get why Jason Patrick would be sort of go to these limits, like to hang with these guys, because he wants to sort of protect her. I mean, she seems kind of torn between them. I mean, when they go to the cave, when he meets with the vampire guys and they go back to the cave and they pull all those mind fucks with him with the whole thing, with the Chinese food, where it's, oh, you're eating maggots, and he looks down and it's maggots, and he drops it and it's just rice, and then the noodles are worms. Like, you know, most people, you'd say, get the hell out of there, dude. You know, you just moved into this town. But he, you know, clearly Jason Patrick's character, because his mom, his family, they're divorced. I don't think they even say if they're divorced.
They do. Yeah, they do. They mention it. Grandpa and he says something to the effect of, you're the only woman I don't know who didn't improve her situation by getting divorced.
Oh, there you go. You're right. So it's like Jason Patrick is clearly the man of the house, and he's protective over his mom, Diane Weist. So he, you know, he's looking at Jamie Gertz as, you know, he's got that in him to be that kind of guy. And you clearly want to pull her away from these scumbags, including Alex Winter, of course, from Bill and Ted.
Oh, they're all such dicks. I know. And that's something that I didn't key in on as much when I was a kid watching it. But now when I watch it, it's like, man, they're just such dicks. They're jerks, right? They're, you know, hanging out on the boardwalk and harassing women. And they're just assholes. But I love it.
Yeah, I mean, Santa Cruz is a particularly – it's one of those towns that kind of only exists in movies that seems to – its economy is mostly based on amusements, you know, where it's like they have this boardwalk and it's like everyone is there in the town. And like, I guess if you run like a Tilt-A-Whirl in Santa Cruz, you're like a millionaire, you know, it's like, like it's a huge thing. And I love the video store that they established that's run by Edward Herman, the great Edward Herman.
This is one
of those video stores that only exists in like your dreams and my dreams.
Sure.
Because it's like, first of all, it's open air, which is great. You just kind of wander in and out of it. It's got a bank of monitors. Like, it's the friggin' Batcave. You know? it's got everything you could possibly want. And you're like, if only a store like that exists. I think like maybe there's like one store like that in L.A. somewhere that's probably that cool. But you're like, how does anybody make enough money to run this video store in this tiny little town?
It's great. I love it. There's a great comic store. You know, I want to live in Santa Carla, man. It's great. Yeah. Who doesn't want to do that? Who does? And that's that. That's an interesting thing that too, because the kind of horror that I really like is the kind of horror where you kind of want to live in that world. Like, I've never been drawn to the really dark, ugly horror. You know, I don't find it entertaining. It just makes me feel like dirty and right. And even more upset with everything. But I love the kind of horror, like, you know, I would love to live in Fright Night, or I would love to live in The Lost Boys. That would be rad, right? So,
that comic book store, I would have shopped there every day in my life. I mean, they have everything. The comic books hanging off the ceiling, for Pete's sakes. One of the things that made me laugh, and just because, like, you know, the way you're like a nerd for facts of life, I'm a nerd for these details, but like when Corey Haim says he's talking to the Frog Brothers, and he's like, I'm looking for Batman number 14. And it's like, that book's like $5,000. What is this kid doing buying Batman number 14? Like, what, is he rich? What are you talking about? Like, they have to go live with their grandpa. They don't have any money. Like, I just, like, laugh at that. Because, like, somebody took the time to, like, dig up an old comic book and use it as a reference. But it's like, they never bothered to look. That it's like, yeah, there's like six of them in existence. Like,
there's
no way Corey Haim has a complete run. If Corey Haim's character has a complete run of Batman, sell that and buy your mom a house. You don't need to go live with Bernard Hughes as crazy old grandpa.
Crazy grandpa.
Because Batman number one is worth like $100,000. You know, like that's it's insane. And then you mentioned like the vampires are dicks. Like, they steal comic books. Not only are they blood-sucking vampires, they're also, as you mentioned, they're a bunch of dicks because they steal comic books. Like, yeah, it's perfect.
They're such miscreants.
It's fantastic.
It's great. And the movie just nails that tone. You know, it's self-aware and it without being cynical. Like, you know, it's not cynical about any of the stuff. It's just fun. You know, it's just fun and it works. And a thing that I think makes it work is that it has great characters. You know, not just the kids, but like, I mean, Bernard Hughes is just an awesome character. I mean, that's a great role. You know, Diane Weist, you really sympathize with her, right? Like, there's that great scene where she's running from Thorne, yeah? And it's scary. And it's actually like, you know, I don't know, man. You like her so much. And there's something very real about the scene where you know, it's not vampires. It's just a scary dog chasing Sam's mom. I love it. I think it's great.
Has Diane Wiest like ever not been good in a movie?
I cannot think of a single time where
and I, you know, like I don't, I have to be careful how I say this because I don't want it to sound like I'm being a dick, but like Diane Wiest, like you can get that she would probably have kind of a difficult time finding a man because I think Diane Wiest's positive qualities are not typically something maybe a single guy is looking for. You know what I mean? Like she seems highly intelligent, which is, we know, a lot of men don't want. And she's not like a classical beauty. She's she's a beautiful woman, but she's not what I guess what we typically, especially in Hollywood, would sort of.
She's actually a real human being. Yeah.
And she seems insecure at times, but she's also very strong in other times. So it's like. She's kind of like a real person. She manages when whatever movie she's in. Of course, she's always in these Woody Allen movies and other stuff. But she creates like a real person. She's a distinct character in this movie, and she's kind of this nice center of normality in the middle of this craziness because both her sons are nuts.
You
know?
Right.
And then they've got the Frog Brothers, you know, who are kind of wandering in from a different movie. And then you've got vampires. Mm-hmm. Edward Herman seems like a nice guy, although of course we know what's happening there. Bernard Hughes is eccentric to the extreme with his, you know, the taxidermied, you know, animals that he's carrying around, and he's got the Jeep that makes the funny thing. So she's like this nice, normal, regular human center in the middle of this craziness, and I give, like, Joel Schumacher all the credit for casting her, because that's a really great choice.
Absolutely, and somebody who's, you know, there's just so much depth to me in little nooks and kind of corners of the movie, like just the idea that just the fact that she's, you know, this single mom and she's living with her father and she's, you know, she's dealing with all these men, right?
Yeah.
Who are all acting like, you know, they're all acting just stupid at some facet, right? And she's kind of stuck in the middle of all this. And then there's, you know, the ultimate motivation that we learn at the end with the whole reason that Max has, you know, kind of set his sights on her is just so fucking skeevy and gross and, you know, awful. And I think that that's an interesting kind of layer of the movie is just, you know, kind of looking at everything from her perspective. And the movie gives her room to be a character, right? It's not so crowded and it's not so like, all the time. You know, it takes time to actually let you feel things for its characters. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, for a movie that's only 97 minutes and has this many characters, that's pretty remarkable. I mean, like you mentioned, like how the vampires are a bunch of dicks. That once Michael starts hanging out with the vampires,
he becomes
a
dick
too.
He does. He's a dick to his mom, man.
Yeah,
come on.
He's sleeping
dick to his
in
brother.
All day. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. They can care of everybody. And you really are just like this poor woman, Lucy. Here's the name of her character.
Yes.
She's just trying to keep all this together. Mm-hmm. And she's getting support from no one. And she reminds me a little bit, retroactively, of the mom from The Babadook.
I can see that.
She's just trying to, like, piece this life together, and everyone is thwarting her at every side. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so when she turns to sort of dating Edward Herman, who, I mean, I always liked Edward Herman, but I think he kind of gives his role from the beginning a slightly creepy bent that you're like, you know, like,
it's pretty obvious from the beginning.
And the fact that she doesn't see that, you're like, well, because she's kind of desperate. You know, she's desperate for someone to make her life easier. And here's a guy who's very sweet to her, and he runs his own business. Of course, you know, he runs a video store, which means he's a multimillionaire. And, you know, he comes with flowers and the whole bit. I love the whole, you mentioned the little details. I love that he refuses to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Until Michael invites him, because of course he has to be invited in, being a vampire.
Yep,
but I love that detail. But you could see why Lucy would be like, "Of course I'm going to go with this guy because he's the only guy that's not treating me badly."
Right, exactly. And it works so well as it's like it's its own kind of horror because you get the impression that she would like very much to be something besides a mom for once, right? You know, she wants to have a life that isn't completely defined by, you know, being a mom to these two boys. And then, you know, that's, there's a horror to me in that, because that's ultimately what he wants for her, right? He wants her to be the mom to his boys too. And it's like, oh man, geez.
Yeah,
I love
he
it.
Just wants to turn her into like this, yeah, this, the run, the queen of the brood. And it's like,
yeah,
it's the last thing that she wants. Yeah. And she's, I really think it's a master stroke. casting her mm-hmm. in the middle of this movie.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned all the little details, and there's a lot of great. I love the constant. We're always seeing missing posters.
Mm-hmm.
I love that
mm-hmm.
detail that for a town that, and you know, the graffiti on the back of the sign that says "Welcome to the Murder Capital," and that's something that Sam and Michael see is kind of like, that's a little. Weird.
That's ominous. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any movie where if you see a town sign where the town sign is welcoming you, that it doesn't mean the bad shit's about to happen, whether it's like
exactly.
Amity or whatever. It's like if you see a sign that says "Welcome to the happiest town on earth," you know there's going to be a chainsaw-wielding right. massacre or something going on. Yeah.
Especially if it cites the population on the sign, then you know you're fucked, right? Like, there's never a good time when you see the population. Interesting. But, you know, and that's kind of cool. Like, Santa Carla was based on, obviously, on Santa Cruz. But the whole reason that the filmmakers, you know, zeroed in on that town is because of it has a really creepy, you know, it really was the murder capital for a while, you know, and there were like, God, three or four serial killers who were operating, you know, around the same time that were connected to Santa Cruz. And, you know, it had this really sinister kind of, this, you know, little town, little beach town, but it had this really gross, you know, violent, bloody history. So, you know,
not to make
I don't know
that,
where I'm going with that. It's interesting.
Well, I mean, again, I don't want to make light of it, but I wonder, like, if you're a serial killer, like, is it better to work in a town where there are other serial killers or is it better
right.
to be by yourself? Cause I feel like, you know, the population can only support so many serial killers before
apparently
it becomes
three to
a
four,
Freddy versus
and then it's
Jason
kind of...
thing, you know, I mean, they're killing each other. I don't know how that works.
I do wonder though, that's an interesting, kind of not to veer too far into the true crime direction, but it's interesting how there's like Seattle, right? Seattle, you know, had an embarrassment of serial killers at one point. It's like, you know, what the hell? What's going on with certain cities, you know?
Yeah,
but,
weird. I had read a little bit of backstage stuff about this movie, and that I think it was Edward Herrmann said that he was told by some of the crew, like, don't go wandering out in the town when you're done shooting.
Really?
Like, kind of, yeah, like, stick around here, because they were... You know, they kind of just gave him a warning of, like, this is not the greatest thing in the world, so maybe you just want to stay in your hotel or something. I thought, ooh, that's kind of ominous.
That is ominous, right? Yeesh.
And nevertheless, wow. though, you know, I mean, Santa Cruz seems like a fun place. I love the whole sequence with the rock band, the greased up rock band with the lead singer that looks like he's right out of Mad Max, like that guy.
And he is, right? He was Tina Turner's sax player, and that's him, you know, in the We Don't Need Another Hero and the Thunderdome song.
That's
him
that
playing
guy?
The sax in that song. Yeah, that's that guy.
Oh my God, I was making uh-huh. a joke. That's fantastic. Oh my God. Because, you know, teens love sax heavy rock and roll. We all
sure.
know that.
Of course.
Punks are big into that heavy fat sax.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
That guy's awesome. He's just this beefcake guy, and he's all, like, shiny, and he's...
He's all oiled up, and
yeah,
it's great. He's wearing
up.
Purple pants, man. Come on.
I love the cave that the guy, the vampires hide out in, which I'm pretty sure was the same hideout from the Sigmund and the Sea Monsters TV show.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I mean, this movie is steeped in pop culture, obviously. I mean, this is one of the first movies I can think of where, like, comic books, again, are, like... That's like a real thing. These are people that read
sure.
comics, and they're I mean, the comic that they're reading about the vampires is a fake comic, but the rest of it's
mm-hmm.
real. Like, all the stuff you see hanging up, those are comics that I owned.
Absolutely.
You know? Like,
that's
like an exciting thing.
And I think that might have been another thing that really made me kind of grab onto this movie, because I was collecting comics then. I mean, I don't know that there have been a lot of things that – of course, now we talk about fan culture so much, and it's such a thing, but then we didn't – you know. We weren't that aware of it, right? And it hadn't become, I mean, it was a thing, but we didn't know it was a thing, kind of,
right.
you know? And, you know, Sam is a total fan. You know, he's a comic book fan. He loves, he's a music fan. He's a movie, you know, he's us in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the kid that I was, that was really into this stuff. And I think the movie kind of anticipated that kind of culture in a lot of ways. And, you know, maybe that's part of what makes it so appealing to people of a certain age. Like
yeah,
mine.
I mean,
so,
right.
Yeah.
On some level, I mean, for a movie about vampires, it feels kind of as real as you can get. The Frog Brothers, like, I understand, like, that the Frog Brothers, I think, are, like, a little of them goes a long way because they're so cartoonish. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think Corey Feldman, I think, was, at this point, he had done Stand By Me. and he had done the Goonies. We see a Goonies poster, actually, in the background, which I thought was a nice little touch from Richard Donner, presumably.
Yeah.
But, like, Corey Feldman, in my mind, was already on his way to, like, you know, Ham Central, where he was just big. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I think that reins in the Frog Brothers is that when they start actually getting in, first of all, they're really motivated. Like, they actually take this shit in their own hands. Like, they actually climb up the stalactite and stab one of the vampires, which is pretty gutsy for some kids to do. But I like that the way they set the Frog Brothers up is that, of course, that they're all talk. They're all talk. But no, they actually get some shit accomplished in this movie.
They actually do it, yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And there's so many great – and you're right, like, a lot more of them probably would have skewed the balance too much in the, like, you know, the kind of silly – ridiculous direction, but they have some great lines. You know, that scene where they're trying to convince Sam to kill his brother is, that's great comedy. You know, it's funny. It's good stuff. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. That does help save it. And you said you could see why that if you'd made this like a Goonies thing, it would have been too much, but they are just weird enough and they're sort of used just in the right, you know, and that scene where Alex Winter gets stabbed, you mentioned all the blood in the court.
Yeah.
It's fantastic the way he's just like writhing and you're not really expecting it because so far the movie's been fairly tame.
Right.
And then when a good man is just boom, let's just drop the buckets of goo on Corey Feldman here.
Yes, it's great. It's great. And their reaction is terrific. You know, they just lose their shit. And, I mean, which obviously who wouldn't? And it's a great scene. And it's, you know, the movie just strikes that balance so often. And, you know, it's one thing to do it in a movie, but they can do it in a scene, right? They can do that pivot immediately where it goes from scary to funny and then back again. And I just think that that's such a mastery of tone that you're like, I don't think this movie is appreciated enough for that aspect of it. Like, I think the script is great. You know, I think it's really well written. And man, that cast, you know, you can't imagine anybody else in any of those roles, you know?
Right. I mean, the train scene where they're all hanging from the bottom again, which again, Stand By Me, enough with the stuff with the trains, but
sure.
Like that whole scene of like kind of making him do a dare. I think that's a terrific sequence. I mean, that's really creepy and weird. And the whole idea of like that, I mean, in a weird way, I hate to even make this comparison, but it's like the vampires are like getting him to trust them, which is like some weird conditioning thing. You know, that you hear about other people do in the more unsavory parts of, you know, where it's like, you know, trust us, you're fine. And then he falls and then it ends up working out. You know what I mean? It's like he doesn't die from fall. And it's like that makes Michael kind of be on their side a little bit, which is great. And I love that that his little brother sort of turns on him so quickly. Like he recognizes this for what it is really quickly. I love the whole thing. He's like, what did you do to my dog, asshole? Like, I love being protective of the dog. I mean,
who cares? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff is, again, Corey Haim, another guy who I was never a big fan of, even as a kid, but he's really good here. He is really good.
He
does
is.
A good job.
Yeah. I always found him, I was never a big Feldman fan, but I always really liked Corey Haim. I had a dip. Like a pinup of him on my wall at some point when I was 12 or whatever. I just thought he was a cute kid, and I liked his, you know, he was just so harmless, right? He just had this such a wholesome kind of harmless, you know, vibe going on, and I really like, I always liked how he reacted to in movies to you know the crazy situations. He always had just in my mind it was a very fun, you know, very. Appealing, I guess, his reaction to chaos. I always really enjoyed, and he does it in The Lost Boys, just brilliantly.
Yeah, he manages to rein in the sort of the cartooniness, and you can see that when he started doing his movies with Corey Feldman, and they became the Coreys. Then it sort of like went into like their worst impulses because then it just became super cartoony. But I mean, when you're controlled by Joel Schumacher again, he's doing. I mean, Schumacher, an easy guy to make fun of now because of some of his later films and whatever. But you know. In the mid-80s, he was really having a moment, you know? I mean, he was kind of this purveyor of a very particular style that not a lot of people were doing. And it's sort of funny when you think about that. He was kind of an older guy, you know?
Right.
It wasn't like he was 23, I mean, but yet he was plugged into this sort of aesthetic, and he seemed to understand it almost intuitively. That's a mark of a good director.
It is. And I feel like, you know, he worked with the actors so well, too, you know? And so much of this movie is him. You know, it really, he authored the Lost Boys in a really, I don't know, his contributions to it going even beyond you know, what we generally think of a director doing. And man, just freaking fantastic stuff.
Yeah, I have to wonder about what, you know, did they have cast rehearsals? Because here you have Diane Wiest, who's like super experienced, and Edward Herman, you know, who played FDR on PBS, for Pete's sakes, you know.
Yeah,
Trying to picture them sitting in a room with Corey Feldman.
With Corey Feldman,
you know? Like,
right.
What do they have to talk about? Was there anything, you know? I mean, the fact that you could sort of balance all that. I mean, I mentioned Edward Herman, you know, here and there, but like, I've always loved Edward Herman. He's another one of those guys that I think was just great in everything.
Whether it was like the Gilmore Girls or FDR.
He's in Oliver Stone's Nixon, which I covered on the show a couple episodes ago. I mean, he was just always tremendous. And I love that he is, again, like Diane Wiest, he's kind of an unusual choice. Like, he's not a classically handsome guy, but he's got enough of a kind of a flinty, weird spin on the way he talks that you could sort of buy. And like, I buy him being a movie nerd. Like, he's a vampire, but he also has to be a movie nerd because he's running this video store.
Because he's running a video store, right? Yeah, and he's charming, you know, and he's got that kind of, yeah, he's got a great, just a great presence. I mean, he's just one of those guys that you just want to watch him. You know, it doesn't matter what he's in, you just want to watch him.
Yeah, he's really an interesting performer. And, I mean, I love that the POV flight scenes.
Oh, yeah.
That was great. I don't recall the first time I ever saw it, but I think this might have been early. That idea of, like, you know, we're going to give you the vampire's point of view as they toddle around. Like, that's really cool. Again, that's a, you know, visual invention to think, like, I don't think we've ever, I mean, we didn't see that in any Bela Lugosi movie or any Hammer movie, as far as I can remember.
Right. Yep. It was a different way to shoot those scenes, and it made it so effective and so scary. You know, I think, especially, you know, toward the end and, you know, talking about the great characters, even the dogs are great characters. You know, Nanook is a fantastic character. And one of the, to me, one, a scene that, and I've seen this movie, Rob, so many times, it's insane. It's just weird. But that scene where Sam runs out to get Nanook because they've left her tied up and the vampires are coming, that scene upsets me every single time. You know, it's like, what a great moment, and what a scary, you know, suspenseful moment. And the film is edited so well, you know, it's just put together in such a great way. And the scary beats, you know, they're effective. And even when you know what's going to happen, you know, when Michael's going up the stairs and Sam's in the bath, and you know, that's a creepy scene. And it hits on a lot of those vampire movie and mythology moments, but it does them in ways that are just so clever. And so, you know, like, when Michael's outside Sam's window, right?
Oh man,
you
know, he can't keep himself from flying away.
Exactly. That's a moment that goes back to, right? You know, Dracula and Salem's Lot. I mean, so many vampire stories have that moment, and this just did it differently, and it made it fun but still scary. It's great.
You think about how terrifying it would be for you, for anyone. Of course, you're not used to flying, and all of a sudden you're starting to levitate, and you don't necessarily know how to control it. Like, that would be huge. Be like, I'm going to float into the ionosphere. Like, holy shit, you know?
And he's grabbing things and trying to, you know, and he sincerely wants help from his brother, and his brother's terrified. And, you know, the movie, it plays on those family dynamics so, so well. I don't have a sibling, but I would imagine that, you know, the way they relate to one another, and it's antagonistic at moments, but it's also very loving and very, you know, gentle. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that to me makes this movie really appealing.
Yeah, it does have all of Joel Schumacher's, to me, his later sins, where to me his movies become very sort of plastic and really kind of just not, they have no emotional resonance at all. This has a lot of nice kind of warmth to it in the middle of this vampire movie, which is,
it does,
you know, which is great. And that's what you need for this kind of thing to work, for it not just to be a joke.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned the end sequence, finally, where they said when you know, they have the dinner and Max reveals the whole bit of what's going on. And it's like, you do feel this poor sense of betrayal. I mean, you knew Max was a vampire. You knew it was coming. But
sure,
just,
yeah.
Like, I like the fake that it's like the Kiefer Sutherland character, who they kind of seem to be suggesting is the big bad of the movie. And he's dispatched relatively simply.
Simply and sadly. Like, that's, it actually becomes kind of a touching moment when he goes, you know, back to being just this you know, sweet-faced kid. And you kind of get this like, that, to me, that image is imbued with a lot of kind of backstory, right? Because that's the moment when you sort of get a sense of who he was, you know, before. And, you know, it just goes back to the idea that they really, leave room in this movie for a lot of kind of just a lot of layers. You know, that's a great scene. And of course that damn, that song, you know, Cry Little Sister is just one of the truly great 80s soundtrack songs, or soundtrack songs period, man. It's rad. It's so creepy and it's just freaking awesome.
Yeah. Schumacher knew how to use music, you know,
he sure
did.
Like
you said, and this was the sort of really the beginning of the MTV thing coming in, where it was like, we're just going to be sort of wall-to-wall music. I mean, you know, they have a cover of People Are Strange, which is by mm-hmm. the Doors, and Jason Patrick is a spitting image
mm-hmm.
for Jim Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like that. I remembered liking that movie, the Oliver Stone movie, just fine, but mm-hmm. when there's that scene where you literally see Jim Morrison behind Jason Patrick, and I'm like...
In the cave, yeah.
Why did they not just get him to do it, you know?
Yeah, like, he would have been perfect.
Yeah.
He had that feel, you know, he had that kind of that, you know, yeah, he would have been freaking great, for real.
Yeah, and so, I mean, after this big finale, where so we find out with this whole battle with Max, and then we bring back in the grandfather, played by Bernard Hughes, and apparently he was like the third or fourth choice for the role. They offered it to Keenan Wynn. I think Keenan Wynn died or something like that, and they offered mm-hmm. it to a couple other people. But one of the things that I appreciate when I see it in a movie, it doesn't happen much, is a movie that knows exactly how to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. the way they bring the grandfather back in, and he has that line about, you know, that he's known all along that Santa Cruz is full of vampires, and he shuts the fridge door, and the light goes out on our main characters, and we're just left with them for like 3 or 4 seconds, and they're just pondering what their friggin'
just
grandfather
that reaction.
Just said. And then the movie ends, you're like, oh.
It's great.
I want to see more of Lost Boys, but I'm also glad the movie ended when it did, because it's perfect.
It went out on a high note, for sure, for sure. And you're right, it does. It leaves you wanting more. And, you know, you want to – anytime you want to stay in that world just a little bit longer, you know, and like you know, you just want – even if it's just a few more seconds, and then it's gone, and it's perfect. It's perfect.
It's like – I've mentioned this on previous episodes. Like, I love the idea of, like – Of there being a movie that follows another movie that's like just 20 minutes long, where you just see what happened to the other characters. Like, I want to see what happened to Shelley Duvall at the end of The Shining. What does she tell? What does she tell those people? Well, there was these skeletons, and there was a guy in a bear mask blowing another guy. And I want to see her I want to see a cop have to write that down in his paperwork. You know, a guy in a bear costume. Okay, hold on, wait a minute. There were skeletons, and there was a thing, and okay. So the Lost Boys, like, what happens after this? Do they stay in town? Does Bernard Hughes just say, well, you know, look, I own the house.
I've dealt with it all these years, you know.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's just part of life, man.
And it is kind of amazing that there was never any sequel to this. You know, like, this movie, it's like a Close Encounters. Like, I know they did a comic book series, I think, starring the Frog Brothers.
Yeah, they did do a sequel, which I have not watched, and I don't ever plan to. It was one of those direct-to-video things. I think it was called The Tribe, right? Yeah, and
It's not the cast.
Yeah, but you're right. And have you heard about the anthology, the series that I don't know if it is it the CW? One of the networks is doing a TV show, and apparently they're planning it, I guess, kind of an anthology thing with each season set in a different era, with just the Lost Boys being the same throughout the...
No!
Yeah, I think that sounds pretty cool, honestly. Like, I think that's an interesting... Like, if you're gonna, you know, if you're gonna do some kind of an adaptation or a different spin on it, I think that's actually kind of an interesting, you know, way to go about it. So, we'll see.
Interesting. Yeah. Not to get off of Lost Boys, but did you see the movie XX?
You know what, the what's his face? The guy? No, I'm thinking Triple X. No, I did not see XX.
Yeah, the anthology movie that's all, and it's four short horror stories directed by four women and starring women.
I did not. I never saw that. I've heard it's good.
It's on Netflix. I watched it because as we're recording this, Darlene Tracy is away for several days, so I could watch it. So because it's too scary for her. But one, and I'm not giving anything away because it becomes obvious if you watch it for 2 minutes. One of this, one of the sequences is basically an unofficial sequel to Rosemary's Baby. It's basically the Rosemary's Baby characters without them being called that. But it's basically Rosemary's Baby with just like a 20-minute sequel to Rosemary's Baby. And I remember watching it thinking, I would love to see a whole bunch of these, of just 20-minute sequels of great horror movies, so you don't have to do a whole movie.
Right.
But you see the characters again, and you're like, well, what happened there? Like, what happens to Rosemary and her baby? years down the line. Well, cool, well, now we get to see it. So I was like, I would love to see the Lost Boys for 20 minutes just to see, well, did the vampires come back? Are there more vampires? Like you know, like, no, I don't want to see a whole nother movie, but just enough to kind of like whet my appetite. That would be kind of cool.
I'd watch it. Just enough to kind of open up that world a little bit and kind of, hell yeah. That's a great idea. I would, I can think, you know, there are probably dozens of movies that I would love to revisit in that format. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, that was great. So, well, I said, The Lost Boys, I, April, I'm so glad that I finally got a chance to get you on the show, and I'm glad that you pointed this movie out, and I'm glad that I don't tell people that I'm not excited about a certain movie that they pick, because it's better to just say, you know, let me try it again, because I really genuinely enjoyed this so much more than I thought I would. So it was really great to watch it again, and it was great to talk with you about it. It was so much fun.
It was so nice. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you. It was cool to revisit the movie with a slightly, you know, more analytical bit and try to figure out why it is that I like it so much, because I've never really thought about, you know, why it appeals to me. So that was a really cool opportunity to revisit that and to talk with the fellow film nerd about it. It was cool.
Awesome. So where can people find you on the internet if they want to read your writing? And they should.
Yep. AprilSnellings.com is my virtual home base. I've got some pretty cool projects coming out. So hopefully they're definitely in that world of horror-centric pop culture that one's going to be announced next month. And it's a collaboration with somebody else that people know in this world. So yeah.
Wow.
Cool things coming up. Yeah.
You always have something hopping. You're always very industrious. You always have multiple projects going on. It's very impressive.
I like having electricity and food and things like that. So,
so cool. You know, okay, princess, you know, what do you want?
All right.
we'll have a link to April's website in our show notes. And we'll also have a link to the Indiegogo campaign to buy her the werewolf. We'll have that too. So, as always, if you want to listen to back episodes of our show, go to our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking movies over on Twitter, which is @FullmanWaterPod. So, April, once again, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. You're just one of my favorite people, and I'm finally glad we had a chance to have you on the show.
It is absolutely mutual. Rob, thank you so much. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Dad, are you all right?
One thing about living in Santa Carla I never could stomach. All the damn vampires.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're